You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire.
Oh my, Mariah's out in a new and improved form. Researchers find buggy smart contracts on Ethereum. A Chase glitch briefly exposed banking customers' information to other banking customers. Hacktivists continue to hit spyware companies. Verizon's mobile index warns that mobile security is being traded for business efficiencies. Talos looks at data security and finds that data breaches seem to have risen with cloud migration. And the FTC doesn't like credential stuffing. I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Friday, February 23rd, 2018. A new variant of the Mirai Internet of Things botnet has been seen in the wild. Fortinet reports that this version is capable of establishing proxy servers in infected IoT devices. They're calling the strain OMG because its configuration table includes strings that contain OOMGA. Why is this development significant? We heard from Gabriel Gums at StealthBits Technologies, who compared illicit proxy servers to a criminal fence, a dealer in stolen goods. Once they're set up, they can be used for any number of illicit purposes. They could be used to stage denial-of-service attacks, or they could be used to drive disinformation campaigns. The fence will handle whatever goods the hoods want to move. We also heard from Sean Newman of Carrero Network Security, who has some related thoughts on what OMG might be capable of. He said, quote, "We're used to seeing Mirai variants being used to commandeer IoT devices. And once the botnet's been assembled, it can run denial-of-service attacks against a particular target. But OMG seems to be nosing out vulnerable IoT devices in an organization, and once it's found them, it puts in the proxy so that device can serve as a gateway into the organization. Once that gateway's established, attackers can exploit it against the victim organization in any number of ways. Reconnaissance, data exfiltration, and so on." End quote. Mirai, of course, came to notice when it was used by some gentlemen in New Jersey to take down much of the internet in the eastern United States in a distributed denial-of-service attack on DNS service provider Dyn. Three young men took guilty pleas this past December in crimes related to the use of Mirai in DDoS attacks against a range of targets. Since 2016, the Mirai code has become widely available, and it's continued to evolve into new forms, like OMG. University researchers in Singapore and London have determined that there are a lot of buggy smart contracts on Ethereum. Essentially, they create a private fork of the Ethereum blockchain and ran various permutations with live smart contracts. They found just over 34,000 contracts vulnerable to undesired actions. They were able to verify and reproduce these trace vulnerabilities on some 3,000 smart contracts that hold about $6 million in Ether cryptocurrency. It would be difficult for criminals to do likewise and steal the money, but the researchers note that it wouldn't be impossible. As one of the researchers noted to Motherboard, the whole business is mucky. University College London's Ilya Sergey said, quote, "We're dealing with applications that have two very unpleasant traits. They manage your money and they cannot be amended," end quote. A glitch in Chase Bank's customer-facing systems is said to have presented some customers with other customers' data. The glitch persisted for about 2.5 hours Wednesday evening, but appears to have been corrected. Chase stresses that the incident was not a cyber attack. Some observers speculate to Krebs on Security that there may have been caching issues at the root of the problem. Motherboard reports hacktivist break-ins at two surveillance software companies, MobiStealth and Spymaster Pro. Hacktivists had earlier hit FlexiSpy and Retina X, so this particular subsector is receiving unwelcome attention. The report characterizes the two outfits as spyware companies, selling privacy-invading stalkerware to private citizens who use it to keep tabs on children, spouses, and other persons of interest. Motherboard also sourly observes that a number of the customer accounts revealed in the data breaches are linked to email addresses from various U.S. federal agencies, DHS, TSA, ICE, FBI, and various military services, especially the U.S. Army. Several reports are out on the state of security. Verizon's Mobile Index for 2018 concludes that many companies are willing to sacrifice some mobile security for business reasons. The 2018 data security report from Talis notes that increased government migration to cloud services has been accompanied by a 20% jump in data breaches. These are perhaps connected, maybe coincidental. You'll find links to both reports in today's CyberWire Daily Briefing. They're worth a look. And finally, the Federal Trade Commission in the U.S. seems moving toward adding some regulatory risk to the reputational risk credential stuffing already poses. The FTC has obtained a consent decree from online tax prep service TaxSlayer on the grounds that TaxSlayer didn't do enough to protect its customers from themselves. Credential stuffing essentially involves a hacker trying credentials exposed in one breach against a variety of other sites. Since people unfortunately tend to reuse their passwords, criminals get hits often enough to make this worth their while. Isn't that the user's fault, you'll ask, since after all, TaxSlayer didn't expose anyone's passwords? Well, the FTC says no. The business should have done more, like requiring multi-factor authentication, requiring strong passwords, and alerting customers promptly whenever a password, address, or security question changed. Those businesses interested in how standards of care are shaping up under the FTC's regulatory lash would do well to consult TaxSlayer's experience.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI. Don't struggle to align your organization's cybersecurity with business risk. Get the only solution that goes beyond reacting to threats with vulnerability and risk monitoring. You need the next evolution of MDR, and only Critical Start delivers it. Critical Start doesn't just monitor and respond to threats. They put you in control by detecting suspicious activities, quickly responding to contain threats, and identifying your most critical assets and protecting them against vulnerabilities and exposures. With continuous visibility, expert guidance, and measurable risk reduction, Critical Start has redefined what it means to manage cyber risk. Demonstrate provable security maturity to your leadership while positioning your program to achieve the greatest risk reduction per dollar spent. Stop fearing risk and start managing it with Critical Start. Visit CriticalStart.com and request a demo today. That's CriticalStart.com.
And I'm joined once again by Emily Wilson. She's the Director of Analysis at Terbium Labs. Emily, welcome back. You know, it's been about 6 months or so since Alphabay was taken down, the primary dark web marketplace. So bring us up to date. Where do things stand? Have things come in to replace that vacuum there?
Not quite. It's been an interesting 6 months on the dark web. Alphabay taken down, Hansa taken down. This fall, we saw a lot of instability around these, you know, prolonged DDoS attacks that went on for several weeks. We lost a couple more markets in the mix. We saw a couple of smaller markets come up to prominence. It's been interesting. So the brief recap, obviously, Alphabay and Hansa taken down in June and July by international law enforcement. And then this fall, the remaining markets, which had been scrambling a bit, kind of power not really consolidating with any one of them, no one of them really coming up to take Alphabay's place. The markets were attacked consistently and unavailable except for through mirror links for probably about 6 weeks. And in that, we saw one market kind of quietly close its doors, you know, thank its customers and, you know, pay out any lost funds, and one market that went down in not at all a respectable blaze of glory. And so now we have a handful of markets, not as many as we did before. We have a couple of older markets that are still stable. We have some newer ones that are coming up. We have some alternative markets, different cryptocurrencies that are being moved around. Really, it's we haven't seen anything come in to fill that vacuum. We've just seen a little bit more skittishness and people adapting to increased uncertainty, which really is what the dark web is all about.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you next, is the sort of tone, the feeling, is there a sense that the people are looking over their shoulders more than they did since we've had these high-profile takedowns?
I think people definitely were in the kind of first wave of the fallout after Alphabay. I think people were with the initial uncertainty with the markets kind of going down this fall, but in general, I think people are adapting, which is what you would expect in this community. People are adapting to having to use alternative links, to following vendors around different markets. I think we're just seeing more loyalty to vendors. I think we're seeing people take a little bit more responsibility for their own security. But by and large, I think the immediate fear and FUD has kind of died down.
And you you say you've seen some interesting trends in some of the fraud markets, some shifts there?
Yeah, so the fraud markets in a lot of ways operate separately as a separate ecosystem from sort of some of the drug-focused markets. We've seen some markets there, you know, go up and go down as markets tend to do, but also some of the markets are going to more restricted access or pay-to-play, and that's just interesting. I think people are kind of trying to protect their membership a little bit more, whether it's, you know, you need to pay to access, you need to get a referral code. I think the community as a whole is just becoming slightly more skeptical.
All right. Thanks for the update. Emily Wilson, thanks for joining us.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
My guest today is Andrea Little Limbago, Chief Social Scientist at Endgame. In her recent blog post on the Endgame website titled "The March Toward Data Localization," she outlines the lag between law and policy and technology and how nation-states are taking different approaches to data security and sovereignty.
So it's one of those things that I think isn't discussed as much in our community. Obviously, it's not as sexy as the latest hack or high-profile cyber attack that's going on. But basically, as we've seen here, there's a lot of policy and legal frameworks has lagged behind technology, you know, across the board in general. But I think it's especially true in information security, where a lot of the laws, especially in the U.S., are 20, 30 years old, and we just kind of keep piecemeal, you know, building on top of them. But the interesting thing is that, you know, that that's actually starting to change. And so after, you know, I'd argue a couple decades of slumber, the policy and legal frameworks are starting to wake up a bit. And I think it's going to really impact cybersecurity for companies and for individual privacy. There's been so much talk about the GDPR, which is a general data protection regulation that's coming into effect in the European Union in May. And so it's one of the first international regulations that's really had some businesses concerned with how, you know, whether they actually adhere to that or not, what needs to be done to comply, those kind of things. And so when these kind of regulations actually start hitting businesses in the U.S., that's when there starts to be more discussion and buzz about it. And so that's sort of what got me looking into it a bit more. And then looking at, you know, the EU isn't the only one, though. And that's one of the things that, you know, for me, I tend to study more so the other countries out there than the EU as much. And so what the GDPR is just one example of this data localization, which is basically country-specific data laws for how data is processed or stored within a given territory. And they vary dramatically. So we're starting to see this large patchwork of data localization laws across the globe. And I just feel like it's something that hasn't been as, you know, it's been making the rounds, obviously, in more of the legal circles, but I don't feel like it has as much information in cybersecurity. And so I want to elevate that discussion and bring it into our community, because it will have a big impact. And then hopefully as well, get more folks in our community with a technical background to provide some insights into how to shape it so we don't turn out with some of these laws we've had in the past that are counterproductive to our own defenses.
One of the points you make in this blog post is that there are two major frameworks that are gaining traction. You describe the multi-stakeholder model and cyber sovereignty. Can you describe those for us?
Yes, it's one of those things where I think that we're at an inflection point in the, you know, looking globally at how the international system is starting to shape itself. You know, if you think about the Cold War, just to sort of frame it as far as something that people know more about. You know, you obviously had the Soviet bloc and you sort of the Western bloc, and that's, you know, with different ideologies and ways of looking at, you know, their economy, how, you know, free flow of information, those kind of things. We're sort of seeing similar ideological divides starting to emerge, not adhering to those same tenets, but it's sort of that bipolarity starting to emerge as well. And so the multi-stakeholder model is one that tends to be more so among European, you know, democratic countries, U.S., Australia, Japan, so forth, that are advocating for more of a free, secure, open internet, sort of the the foundations for how the internet was actually, you know, how it was founded and emerged, sort of the more of the utopian on how the free flow of information can help promote societies, help economic development, help governance, provide, you know, access to all sorts of information where people previously didn't have that. And so that's sort of on the one hand, and then within that is a big emphasis on individual freedoms and individual security and privacy. And so one thing I will say, these are sort of the overarching umbrellas, and obviously each country kind of adheres to these in different ways. So it's not just black and white, but these are sort of the two big buckets. And then the other one would be cyber sovereignty. And that, you know, on the surface, you know, ostensibly it sounds really great. It's, you know, each country should have control over data within their own borders. So it sounds very similar to the notion of sovereignty, where they have, where governments have control of the laws and the legal frameworks, monopoly on the use of force, those kind of things within their own borders. And so, you know, perhaps it's just elevating that to, you know, the cyber realm. But it's really not there. It's under the umbrella of that, but really what a lot of it is countries using this notion of cyber sovereignty for greater control of data. Accessing data for individuals within the country, it helps justify various forms of censorship and what does and does not make it onto the internet. So really, if you want to think about it, it's government control of the data. So it really is much more so limiting of personal privacy and more so empowering governments to have control and access to whatever data they want within a country. And that'd be more indicative of like China, Russia, but a lot of other ones as well are starting to introduce similar laws.
And so having those two different frameworks, what are the natural tensions that are introduced between them?
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. So on the one hand, because it's been somewhat evolving slowly and it's really starting to manifest itself quite a bit over the last few years, the tensions are starting to emerge. And one of the places where you see it a lot, unsurprising, is at the United Nations. So as the United Nations was trying to set forth what some global norms would be for cybersecurity, so what are the appropriate rules of the road that countries should adhere to, so what may or may not be off limits for an attack, what may or may not be off limits for, for accessing data, those kind of things. And so, for the UN, who has historically been there just to help establish, international guidelines for country behavior, and trying to establish those kind of guidelines at the international level for cyber is really, really difficult, because for the past 5 or 6 years, the United Nations has a group of governmental experts that's been trying to pull together these various rules of the roads and the guidelines. And just last year, it completely fell apart. And my understanding is that people who have been in, were in within some of the discussions, it was this tension between the view of the world from the China, Russia, and some of those kind of countries, those perspectives, in contrast to what European Union, United States, and democratic countries were trying to push for what the norm should be. And so we saw those discussions just completely fell apart last year. And so right now, it remains an area of just, the internet remains largely an anarchic system where there is no supernatural control. And so every country is going to be doing their own thing, which basically means that so far, countries vary dramatically on what is off limits for targets, what's the right behavior, what kind of cooperation is okay. All those things across the board are just up to every country's whims and up to their own incentives. So that's probably one of the biggest areas. But then you also see it a lot as far as bilateral relations between countries. You're starting to see more and more bilateral cyber agreements going on. And you see them a lot generally within each of these different areas. So you see the democracies starting to do their own bilateral agreements in cybersecurity, and then the authoritarian regimes. And you do see a little bit, the U.S. and China did do an agreement along the lines in 2015 of what would be off limits to ban cyber espionage for commercial purposes. But again, because there's no teeth onto it, there's no repercussions for failing to adhere to that, it really hasn't had the teeth to actually provide any changes, long-term changes in behavior.
That's Andrea Little-Limbago from Endgame. You can read her full report, The March Toward Data Localization, on the Endgame website. It's in the blog section. We've got an extended version of this interview on our Patreon site at patreon.com/thecyberwire. Our Patreon supporters get first access to it, and in a few days it'll be available to the general public. And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow. And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.